We've moved into the who knew what when phase of the Wells Fargo scandal. We'll tell you about that. Also, old timers playing softball and what that means for the future of manufacturing in this country. Day two from Rochester, New York, from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Risdahl. It is Wednesday, the 28th day of September. Good to have you along, everybody. Wells Fargo, it seems, is the banking story that keeps on giving. Item one, CEO John Stumpf is going to lose a big chunk of his pay package. Item two, Mr. Stumpf is going to spend another uncomfortable couple of hours in front of Congress tomorrow explaining exactly how it came to be that the bank opened 2 million fraudulent customer accounts, which gets us to item three, Fed Chair Janet Yellen, who had her turn in the hot seat today in her capacity as a key banking regulator. The Fed does more than just interest rates, you know. There were various congressional calls to break up Wells Fargo, in response to which Dr. Yellen said this.
We will hold the largest organizations to exceptionally high standards of risk management, internal controls, consumer protection.
Yes, but that didn't happen in this case. The Los Angeles Times started reporting the Wells story in 2013. Here we are, 3 years on. Who's been minding the store? From New York, Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
A fish rots from the head down, the old saying goes, which is perhaps one reason why the Wells Fargo board has cut CEO John Stumpf's pay by at least $41 million. But where was the board before now?
The board first knew of the misconduct in 2013, 3 years ago. What were they doing?
Patricia McCoy is a law professor at Boston College Law School. Boards of directors have a special responsibility to assess risk and compensation methods, she says. It's their job.
But they didn't do that. The compensation incentives that were the high-octane fuel for the illegal account openings remained in place. The cross-selling strategies remained in place.
But regulators have some responsibility, says Anat Admati, professor at Stanford's Graduate School of Business. There are laws in place related to tying, selling you something and forcing you to buy something else, which is a bit like what Wells Fargo did.
And the Fed is in charge of implementing rules, of writing rules about that, and the Fed has just not done that.
The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau did eventually extract a record settlement from Wells Fargo.
A little long and a little late coming.
Joshua Rosner is a partner at Graham Fisher, a regulatory consulting firm. He says regulators generally, not just the Fed, should have picked up on this sooner.
These systemically important financial institutions are just too big to be effectively regulated and monitored.
Even for Wells Fargo, apparently, by its own board. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Ticker symbol WFC up a hair today. Wider markets up a bunch. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This past April, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton were making the campaign rounds, and coincidences being what they are, they made the same stop just 2 days apart.
Every place has been hurt, but Rochester in upstate New York has been decimated, okay? You've been decimated.
There is a lot going on now in Rochester, and we've got to keep it going.
The Rochester they were talking about, and two, for that matter, is Rochester, New York, where just 25 years ago, 60% of the workforce in the area worked in manufacturing for one of three companies, Xerox, Bausch & Lomb, and most notably, Kodak. Today, just 2% of them still do. We were talking yesterday about Rochester's past, older guys on a slow-pitch softball team who used to work for Kodak.
I was a supervisor.
There was an electronic technician.
Toolmaker.
And we heard about the glory days of working for a company that was once the fifth most valuable brand in the world.
You couldn't beat it.
I mean, we had cafeterias.
Ping pong tournaments. My aunt used to play on a golf league that traveled. Bowling leagues traveled.
We used to have lunchtime movies in the auditorium.
It was something else.
Today, part two, the future of manufacturing and how it has changed. In a city where the phrase around town used to be, a job at Kodak is a job for life. It's our series with Frontline and PBS NewsHour. It's called How the Deck is Stacked. This is the main campus. Is this the original part of Kodak?
This is the original eastern part of Kodak, started in 1890. By 1894, rolls of film were coming out of this facility.
Wow. Mike Ault and I are out for a drive on the grounds of what was once known as Kodak Park.
Give me your biographical sketch. You were Kodak for how long? Or
35 years, right out of college.
Doing what?
I'm a chemical engineer.
We're driving into the heart of what American manufacturing used to look like, actually. The park is nearly 4 miles long. It used to have more than 100 buildings. 45 of them have been demolished, now marked by empty gravel lots. The 63 buildings that are left are reminders of the company's past.
And that was George Eastman's original office at the park, up there on the third floor.
Huh. There are smokestacks and 7 miles of railroad, stacks of coal that still power the place, and miles of metal tubes snaking above ground, connecting each facility like a circulatory system.
So what's going through all these tubes?
It's all the utilities.
Yeah.
Steam, chilled water, compressed air, nitrogen, electricity, everything you see. This facility is a standalone facility. It is completely off the grid.
Is it really?
Yes. This is one of the largest industrial sites in the country.
In a lot of ways, Kodak Park is a monument to American manufacturing at its height. The place was vertically integrated. Everything was made here, down to the gelatin in the film and the tiny screws in each camera. Kodak does still make film here, albeit a fraction of what it once did. The company went from 62,000 employees here in Rochester in the early 1980s to just 1,600 today. After declaring bankruptcy, the company began leasing out space at Kodak Park and changed the name to Eastman Business Park. Mike Ault is the guy whose job it was to turn the place into something new.
But now, of course, Kodak is just a shell of its former self. Is that fair?
So Kodak is smaller and more focused.
There are more than 70 different companies operating out of old Kodak buildings today, everything from spaghetti sauce to medical marijuana. One of the companies Ault helped broker a deal with is a chemical manufacturer called Cigna Chemistry. They asked him to come run their new operation, so he is now Cigna's vice president of technology and manufacturing.
All right, you don't have any air conditioning in here, first of all.
It looks like a typical manufacturing operation, cement floors, steel doors, and rows of machinery.
Talk to me for a second about the change in manufacturing and the size of Cigna and what you're doing now versus equivalent stuff 30 years ago, right? Because manufacturing in this country is completely different.
It is. We have a crew of three people that run this facility, where years ago it would have been much more. And that's a big change. You know, a lot of the lower technology manufacturing operations have gone offshore. What we want is to keep and grow the high-technology ones, but there won't be the same number of employees that used to run those. Those will be down. And I don't know if the factor is 2X, smaller, or 4X. It depends. But clearly, this facility, we've automated a lot of the operation, and we'll continue to automate those so that our operators now have to be very smart. They have to have basic chemistry skills. They have to have good math skills, but they have to have very good troubleshooting skills.
Can I get a job in Cigna at this park straight out of high school?
Maybe with 2 or 3 years of industrial experience, but probably not right out of high school
right now.
The manufacturing jobs still pay a very good middle wage position. And so people can come and work for a manufacturing because we're selling products throughout the world, and they can make a very good living versus the service sector. So we still need these middle wage jobs, and I don't know where they're going to come from if they don't come from manufacturing.
Right.
For people who choose not to pursue a college or some other trade.
Right.
I wanted to get a sense of what it was like to work in manufacturing these days, so Mike tracked down one of the three people working on this floor, a tall, burly guy in a blue jumpsuit and safety goggles.
Here's Chad.
Hey, Chad. Kai Rizdahl, nice to see you. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm well. Tell me about yourself.
My name is Chad Kenyon. I'm a lead operator here at Cigna Chemistry. I was born and raised in Rochester, 28 years old. I've got two kids, one on the way.
When you got out of high school, what'd you do?
I went to college for a little bit, and then I really went straight to work. Went to Subway, and I was a store manager there for a while.
From Subway to chemical manufacturer. Is this a good job?
That's a great job. It's probably the best job I've ever had in my life.
How much are you making?
Good money, like $50,000 a year. But
and in Rochester with two kids and a wife and one on the way, that's good?
Pretty good, yeah.
Yeah. So in a way, it's funny, right? Because your dad's generation is the generation that got out of high school, came to Kodak, and was here for 35 years, right? Doing manufacturing or whatever they were doing.
Right.
You're sort of in that step now.
Yeah. This is it for me. I'll be here for life. As long as they are willing to keep me employed and stay in business, which I'm sure they won't have a problem doing that, I'm here.
The decline of Kodak and the other two of the big three, Xerox and Bausch & Lomb, slowly pulled the rug out from under the economy in Rochester, but it also at the same time created the threads to reweave it. Case in point, this guy.
I'm Michael Muller. I'm the CEO and founder of Molecular Glasses.
Last November, Muller launched his startup in a building in Eastman Kodak Business Park. Molecular Glasses makes organic materials for electronics.
This is what we're making.
And the it looks like a little pile of glass.
This is an organic material, but because the way we make it, it behaves like a glass.
Wow.
It's still as in a liquid form even when you solid. It's like honey.
Can I touch it? Can I poke it around? Is it going to cut me?
No.
No, because I can't touch it. Okay.
These materials have to be 100% pure. And
oh, okay.
A kilogram of that will be 25,000.
Wow.
That's very expensive material.
We have one, two, three, four rooms here, right? It's a tiny little lab that you rent from Kodak.
We're renting that from Kodak, yeah.
And you, I mean, you've got a long history at Kodak. You were 36 years at that company?
Yes.
And you left because?
Actually, Kodak left me.
Aha. And it was 2010-ish, right?
That's when 2010. Yeah.
Economy was lousy. Here you are, 50-something years
really
old, out of a job.
Because I never thought that I would be not able to find a job.
Right.
And I couldn't.
And you decided to invent this or manufacture this stuff.
Yeah, that's how we started, yeah.
Not only is Mike Muller a former Kodak employee, but the material he's making was actually created by Kodak, a technology they decided wasn't worth pursuing.
And we are actually, I mean, as we were walking in, your office for 10 or 12 years at Kodak was right down the hall.
Right down the hall, yeah.
It's like you're just coming to work all over again.
And that's right now, we are three of us.
Yeah.
And when we need some help, we hire some temps.
Right.
And we are very lean and trying to, you know, conserve cash.
Of course. You're a startup, right? So, yeah.
Yeah.
How old are you?
How old? I'm 65.
65 running a startup.
Yeah, I know. That's the scary part.
We started this story yesterday at a softball game. A bunch of guys who used to work at Kodak. Guys you would picture if you thought back to the glory days of American manufacturing. Maybe the best insights, though, came from a woman I met shooting the breeze in the bleachers.
I'm Michelle Steffen.
She's married to one of the guys playing, Chuck Steffen. We talked to him yesterday. And you were Kodak for how many years?
20 years. Started in assembly, worked my way up into the contracts department. I was a contract negotiator when I left.
All with just a high school degree. And she said a lot of the same things her husband and the others said about Kodak's omnipresence in this town. But when I asked her what it was like back then, she said this.
Oh, my God, you didn't even have to go to college. You get out of high school, you go to Kodak, you make $20 an hour. Delco, Rochester Product, Xerox, all the top, Bausch & Lomb. You know, back in the day, you got out of school and you can be 18 and go move off on your own into an apartment. Today, these kids today, if you don't have college, you're not, there's not, those top companies are just not here anymore.
Do you have kids?
Yeah, three.
They're grown?
Grown, grandkids.
Where are they? Do they stick around Rochester?
My daughter's a teacher. My other daughter's in school right now. She's going to want to be a business manager. And my son's a stay-at-home dad.
But they all went out and they went to college and they got training.
Did it the hard way, though, and she found out that without college here, there is only $13 an hour jobs, if that. So still at home, 31, but back to school now to try get that degree to get out on her own because there is not those kind of jobs. There was an article in this paper this past weekend about, middle class America, so many jobs are coming back, $12 to $15 an hour. What? Like, what are you going to do with $12 to $15 an hour? You cannot live on your own.
The crazy thing about Rochester is that there are more jobs in the metro area today, even adjusted for population growth, than there were back when Kodak and Xerox and Bausch & Lomb were going strong. But most of those jobs aren't in manufacturing. The big three today are the University of Rochester, the University Hospital, and Wegmans, a grocery store chain where half the people work part-time. So if you're looking for a microcosm of the American economy headed into this election, Rochester's pretty much it. Less straight-up manufacturing, more service jobs, and jobs that need some skills. Rochester was and is a city that knows how to make things. It's just not the same softball game anymore. There is more of this story, some great pictures, videos, all that jazz. It's at our website, marketplace.org. Coming up.
I wrote a book called The Crash Detectives, but it's an uplifting book.
No, it really is. Staying safe at 30,000 feet. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 110 points today, 0.6%, 18,339. The NASDAQ up 12 points, 0.25%, 5318. The S&P 500 up 11 points, about 0.5%, 2171. Energy stocks rebounded on reports that OPEC members have agreed to limit oil production. Cutting that supply should bump up prices. That's the way that whole supply-demand thing works. Occidental Petroleum spurted up 4.75%. ExxonMobil moved up 4.4% today. Phone companies AT&T and Verizon both rang up losses. AT&T slammed down 1.5% after an analyst downgraded the stock from buy to neutral. He also cut his profit forecast for Verizon, which lost 0.8%. Can you hear me now? Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.57%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is going to sound obvious, but I'm going to say it anyway. Airplanes burn a lot of gas. A lot. Which means they produce a lot of greenhouse gases. A lot. Which climate negotiators would like to do something about. A lot. The problem is that the global climate deal that got signed in Paris last year doesn't cover aviation. So this week, negotiators in Montreal are trying to cut a cap-and-trade deal to cover international flights. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong is on that one.
The goal here is to make airlines stop adding to their carbon footprint in 5 years. Here's how. If emissions at, say, Delta or United go up, the carriers would then have to do something. For instance, they could innovate, says Annie Petzonk at the Environmental Defense Fund.
They could reduce them potentially by flying more fuel-efficient aircraft. Some companies are looking at biofuels. They're looking at having better air traffic control so that planes don't have to spend so much time hanging around in the sky waiting for a place to land.
Or they could offset emissions, that is, buy credits and invest in decarbonization, a wind or a solar farm, or they could plant forests, which absorb CO2. Now, there is controversy here. Offsetting lets airlines basically outsource their greenness to non-airlines. Dan Rutherford is with a research group called the International Council on Clean Transportation.
They would pay to take credit for emission reductions made in other sectors rather than take additional action themselves. This is viewed as the cheapest way out.
The counter here is that this carbon market lets companies shop around for the cheapest eco-solution. Saves money for everyone, says Anthony Mansell at the Center for Climate and Energy Solutions. Now, if this UN deal goes through, he says it'll join a growing list of cap-and-trade markets around the world.
You know, the size of this market will ultimately depend on what the final agreement looks like, but it's going to be highly significant to have an entire sector of the global economy using a market-based approach.
Negotiators hope to land a deal by next Friday. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
We turn now to the world of beer, the wonderful world of beer, some might say, and the merger between the world's number one and number two brewers that was okayed by shareholders today. Anheuser-Busch InBev is going to buy SAB Miller for more than $100 billion. It's one of the biggest corporate mergers ever, but let's get down to the nitty-gritty here, shall we? What is this deal going to mean for the price and the oh-so-important taste of beer? Marketplace's Andy Euler cracks this one open.
The deal means that about one in every four beers sold around the world will be a product of this new mega brewer. Bart Watson, chief economist for the Brewers Association, says pay attention to around the world.
I mean, this wasn't about the U.S. market as much as it was about developing markets where SAB Miller was strong and where AB InBev was weak.
Beer consumption has been down for years in the U.S. and Canada. Africa is a big growth market. The company says that's where it's going to focus. Okay, so what does that mean for us? Dirk Hackbarth teaches finance at Boston University. He says this amount of market share doesn't mean it'll start charging whatever it wants for beers, but...
That said, the price of beer is not going to go down. If it's going to be $25 a can, I doubt. But while you may not see the price ratchet up as quickly, you maybe just see sort of a quiet, slow growth in prices.
Sure, but what about the taste? Jason Foster is a beer writer based in Canada.
Given the overall trends in the beer industry, I don't think we'll see homogenization of the flavors. Like, it's not like suddenly, you know, Miller's will taste like Budweiser.
That's unlikely anyway, given that SAB Miller had to sell off some assets like Miller Lite to appease regulators, but you get the idea. What Foster's more concerned about is what this will do to craft brewers.
And I think that's the problem, that they'll have increasing motivation to try and create, you know, what I like to call pseudo-craft offerings. in an attempt to try and sort of gobble up even bigger market share.
Because really, 27% of the world's market share just isn't enough. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
A team of international investigators said today that Malaysia Airlines Flight 17, the passenger plane shot down as it flew near the Ukrainian-Russian border a couple of years ago, was shot down by a missile that had been brought into Ukraine from Russia. This one is going to be litigated for a good long while yet, but figuring out how commercial airliners crash can be of utmost importance in making sure that more commercial airliners don't crash. That's the topic of a new book by Christine Negroni. She's an aviation journalist and an aviation safety specialist. The book is called The Crash Detectives. Christine, welcome to the program.
It's nice to be here. Thank you so much for having me, Kai.
When investigators go to the scene, where do they start? What's step one?
There are many step ones. Let me put it like that, because
there
are many different ways.
Step one
is a multi-level, multi-purpose activity. But I have to say that the sexy part, the thing that everyone thinks about, is the work of the, and I'm using air quotes here, the tin kickers, the people who actually go out, find out the, you know, the what they call the four corners of the wreckage site, where is the nose, the tail, and the wings, and then sort of work their way in towards, you know, how the plane came apart and what was happening at the time, the whatever catastrophe happened, when it happened.
The investigations, actually, for any given air crash contribute to design and safety improvements in the next generation of planes as well, too, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That is the purpose of an accident investigation. It's not to let the families know what happened, and it's not to let the lawyers know what happened.
Wow.
It is to prevent this happening again in the future. That's absolutely the reason for an air crash investigation.
This is probably an opportune time to stop and point out that air safety in commercial aviation in this country and most of the rest of the world, I imagine, has never been higher. It's exceptionally safe.
Yes.
There you go. I figured we had to get that one on the record. That was a shorter answer than I expected, but I suppose it's good, right? Because that means investigations are doing their job.
Yes, and you know, and frankly, I wrote a book called The Crash Detectives, but it's an uplifting book. At the end of the book, we learned that the role of the human has never been more important, that the role of the human is essential, indispensable, that though humans make mistakes, predictably we make mistakes, left, right, and center we make mistakes, our ability to be resilient and take a novel approach when things go wrong saves the day. That's something to be celebrated.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. But this idea of technology and airplanes and the idea that we are now more vulnerable as a society, and you extend that to our infrastructure because of hacking and cyber mischief, as planes become more high tech and technology oriented, is that anywhere on aviation safety inspectors and investigators' minds?
Yes. And not only that, Kai, but, you know, you talked about aviation has never been safer. And I answered short, but I probably should have been
no,
more expansive.
That's fine. So, it was good.
But here's the sort of the interesting part of that. Aviation has never been safer because we have essentially conquered most of the problems that emerged in the first century of commercial flight. Hmm. But now we're starting into the second century of commercial flight, and there's all sorts of new and different challenges. One of them, the cybersecurity, the increasingly electronic digital airplane. But then there's the second, that is the increasingly automated cockpit in which the human does less and the machine does more. And how will we deal with them? I don't want to be too pessimistic, but we'll deal with them because of disasters.
Right.
That's how we learn. So yes, is aviation safe? Yes. Do we have new challenges on our horizon? Absolutely.
The most recent book by Christine Negroni is called The Crash Detectives. Christine, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
It's a good read, actually, and not at all scary in the plane crash sense, if you're worried about that. We've got an excerpt from Crash Detectives at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, in which the sixth biggest economy in the world hits Wells Fargo right in its pocketbook. This afternoon, California State Treasurer John Chang cut Wells out of doing business with the state, including the oh-so-profitable business of underwriting state bonds. Here is John Chang's quote. I'm just going to read it to you. "How can I continue to entrust the public's money," he said, "to an organization which has shown such little regard for the legions of Californians who placed their financial well-being in its care?" End of quote. There you go. All right, we're done. Today, the Dow up about 0.6%, the NASDAQ up 0.25%, the S&P 500 up about 0.5%. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.